Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we greatly appreciate you taking time today to either join us live or to listen to us on the podcast. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that is with us live, we'd like to invite you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or if there's even a question you would like for us to weave in during the course of the show to our guest, that's a great place to put it because we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. And we're more than happy to steal other people's great ideas. If you got to leave and take care of some business, if you're with us live and you want to catch up on what you missed, remember, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or one of the other aggregators and listen at your leisure. And today we're going to do something not very leisurely. We're going to make your brain hurt. At least I hope that's what we're going to do if we do it right. Because today we're going to reach into those higher brain functions and talk about those things that are a foundation to not just what your, to use a cliche, your strategic corporal does when he's on the deck, but also what our leaders in civilian outfit who are establishing direction and guidance from the pole mill level hopefully is part of their decision-making process is they give everybody what they need to do. And we're going to talk about the lines between ethics, morality, legality, values, talk about where those lines are, what's personal, what's professional. Hopefully we'll be able to touch on the individual nature of some of these things in the military, but also institutional and national. The differences perhaps in cultures and perspectives that can inform how these are not just looked at and interpreted, but how they operationalize in the day-to-day operations. And our guest for the full hour today to talk about this and related topics is Dr. Pauline Shanks-Curran. She is the professor of military ethics at the Naval War College. She holds a PhD in philosophy from Temple University, specialized in military ethics, just war theory, philosophy of law, and applied ethics. Before she went over to Naval War College, she was associate professor and chair of philosophy at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington, where she taught military ethics, warfare, business ethics, social, and political. And if you like what you hear today and you would like to keep track of her, you can always find her over on Twitter at the appropriate Queen of Thin Air. Pauline, welcome to Midraps.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on, gentlemen.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and I kind of feel a little mad at myself in a way that we didn't invite you on before, because I think the more that you talk to people about what we do in the national security arena, that we talk a lot about technical items, budgetary items, are we doing this, that, or the other thing with people? And it's almost like existing on a planet without recognizing there's an atmosphere between all the objects you're looking at. And people talk a lot about ethics and morality and legality, but do we really know what it is? And for those that are familiar with your work or have seen some of your presentations, I think this is going to be a great show to kind of describe that ether between what we're looking at and talking about and how it actually is all held together. And if you could help us out and the listeners, I think you have to help us set a good foundation, because I think I've been guilty of this in the past, and a lot of people have, is using words interchangeably that at the beginning you need to understand there is a relationship between the two. And I think the easiest things to get confused is, you know, what is ethical and what is moral. So start off a bit, just kind of outline for us where that line is that people need to keep in the back of their head when either they or somebody that they're listening to is talking about something involving ethics or morality.
Sure. And I would just say to start with that I'm trained as a philosopher, so we're kind of picky about definitions, and these two terms are hard because we use them interchangeably. So when I talk about morals or morality, what that means is some kind of claim or idea or system of ideas about what's right or wrong. So that might be my personal moral beliefs that it's wrong to be cruel to animals. It might be the Navy's core values. It might be my church's commitment to equality. Any kind of claim about what is right and wrong would be moral or morality. So we all have these. We try to teach our children these. Institutions have these. The military has these. So that's what morality is, and often it's informed by culture, and often people disagree about what's moral and what's not moral. Ethics involves, and for philosophers, ethics is the study of morality. And so ethics is a higher order reflection upon these moral claims, moral ideas, or moral systems. And so if I tell you that I think eating bacon on Tuesday is wrong, I'm making a moral claim. And if you ask me, okay, Pauline, that's really interesting, why do you think that? Then you're asking an ethical question. So ethics has to do with reflection or questioning or challenging or giving justification or giving arguments for or against moral claims. So the topic of ethics is morality. Ethics is looking at morality. And it's trying to give some kind of higher order analysis or reflection upon morality. So if you want to think hierarchically, then you have morality as the basis, and ethics is one step above that. Now, in the military, this is complicated by the fact that they also use ethics to refer to all kinds of legal and bureaucratic rules. So when I came on at the Navy War College, part of my indoctrination process was to go and meet with the JAG office, very nice people, and they handed me a lovely card and it had the top 10 ethical, the code of ethics, which I thought as an ethicist was really interesting because those were actually a list of rules or a list of moral commitments. So when I'm using ethics, I love my JAG colleagues, but I'm not using the term in the same way that they might. Or in government, we have ethics offices. Those are offices that really are about, are people following the laws or rules that are set out. So I'm using the term in a different way to denote some kind of higher order thinking about moral claims. And possibly legal claims. But we tend to make a distinction in philosophy between moral and legal, that those are different kinds of domains. So when I'm talking about ethics, what I'm talking about is looking at someone or some institution or some group's claims about or ideas about what is right and what is wrong.
Well, let's put that in a larger context. The military is part of U.S. military is part of a much larger social structure. What is the impact of the, if you will, the ethics of the civilian population and its impact on the or interaction with the military? Does that question make any sense?
Do you mean the morality of the civilian society from which the military comes, or are you thinking about sort of the two cultures?
Well, we have a structure in our country where the military is subordinate to the civilian government, and the civilian government is subordinate to the population. There's an interface. There are so many different interfaces there. Maybe this is an impossible question to answer, but is there an ethical interface where the population says, you know, we believe in this, this is why we should do these things, and that goes to the government, and it finally reaches down to the military? But are they compatible? Are they sometimes incompatible or mutually exclusive? Is it, you know, I'm trying to get at, this is a more of a sociological question probably than a philosophical question, but we swim, as Mao said, we swim in an ocean. we're fish in the sea. So
that's right. Well, I think it depends how strongly you're committed to the idea of civilian control in the military and whether or not you think the civilians can be wrong, right? So I think certainly in civilian society and in our political structure, there are certain both political and moral values that the United States in its civilian leadership at any given time, they're sort of, I guess, maybe not eternal, but values that tend to be consistent across administrations. And then there are other values that kind of ebb and flow and change a bit depending on who's in power and what the political structure is and what the, you know, what's going on in the larger society. So I think, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I do think that they can be in conflict sometimes. So civilians might want to do a particular thing in the military, which has, if you think of the military as a profession, which I do, then there are certain norms and moral values that that profession is committed to, and those may come into conflict at times with what civilians or some politicians want to do. And so we do have civilian control of the military, but it's an interesting philosophical question about whether civilians can be wrong and what the military does if they think what the civilian leadership is asking them to do is immoral or highly problematic. So it's not an easy relationship, and I think a lot of times there's consistency and agreement between the two, but sometimes there isn't agreement, and that's an interesting sort of problem to negotiate. It's a classical problem, moral disagreement. What do you do when you have two groups or individuals who have different conceptions of what the good life is or what morality requires in a given context? So, which is why you need ethics, because ethics helps us think through those conflicts. Otherwise, it's a shouting match between two sides saying, no, this is moral, no, this is moral. It's sort of like your two kids screaming at each other fighting. You got to have mom or dad come in and say, okay, let's figure out how we're gonna negotiate this or how we're going to settle this or come to some kind of accommodation.
One of the neat things that I have is both of my daughters have gone to the same school that I went to, and in two cases had some of the same teachers, and it's a really good liberal arts and one of the things that they pride themselves in, and he's no longer there, but one of my teachers said, I'm here to make you uncomfortable and to make you think, and they to this day still teach critical thinking. And in the military, one of the things that often comes into conflict where you find yourself uncomfortable with yourself and arguing with yourself, which I don't think you need to be schizophrenic or anything like that. I think it's a healthy thing to do. But oftentimes you can have your personal ethics come into conflict with professional ethics. What is a healthy way of looking at that, either when you come upon it, or what should you be looking for to kind of square that when you run up into a conflict between your personal and your professional ethics?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that I think that happens. It's not an uncommon thing to have happen, particularly when you're a member of a profession. So you have a professional code of ethics, or you're part of a community of practice that has certain kind of moral commitments. I'm always nervous about saying that your personal ethics trump those. There may be times when you decide that your personal code of ethics really cannot be reconciled with the professional code of ethics. Hopefully that's something you should have thought about, or you would have had some time to reflect on before you joined the profession or in your early days in the profession. So if you're a pacifist, perhaps joining the profession of arms is going to cause some difficulties, right, depending on what part of the profession you are part of. So hopefully some of that takes place up front. You think about it beforehand. Also think about what the possible conflicts might be, and think about how you're going to resolve them. I think very often there are ways to negotiate that conflict in a way that's not about compromising your personal beliefs, but it's about seeing your personal beliefs in a particular vein, in that you are one person who is part of a larger community. And if you took an oath to be a member of that community and uphold those values, then that is also a personal commitment that you've made. And so that may be a way of ordering the personal and the professional. In the most extreme circumstances, it may be that you have a very strongly held personal belief and you're asked to do something as part of your job that is just is inconsistent with that. And so it may come down to, say, resigning your commission, or in some other way, for some people, maybe disobeying an order or something like that. But that's pretty radical. And also, I don't think of, I have a, next year, hopefully my book on obedience will be out. And one of the things I argue in that book is that obedience and disobedience are not a binary. There's a range. And so there may be ways to negotiate moral claims, both personal and professional, in ways that can work out. And if there aren't, then they're sort of more radical ways in which you may decide you need to draw a line. But I think that's part of being an ethically aware and a person who has ethical capacity is to know that sometimes you're going to have to make those kinds of judgments, and to have thought about them, and to be able to give reasons, rationalizations for those, which isn't to say people are going to like what you're going to do. That's the other thing. I think we want to stand up for our moral beliefs, but we don't want it to cost us anything. And sometimes it just doesn't work that way. Sometimes, it does cost people to be ethical. And that's why it's interesting. It's only if it never costs you anything to be moral, that's not very interesting. You're just doing what's convenient. It's only when there's a conflict that we really find out what people's commitments are and to what degree they're able to engage in ethical reflection and ethical discernment about what they should do.
Yeah, I think the conflicts arise in the ethical world, so sometimes more in surprising situations. And I remember during the Kosovo War, Russians had moved in toward the Pristina airport. The British commander on the ground was ordered to stop them or intervene in that area, and he rejected that order, thinking that it was his ground was that it was going to possibly cause World War III. Is that an example of an ethical decision that he didn't think that was the right thing to do, and he refused the order?
Yeah, and I think we have to ask, given every judgment, every moral judgment we make, and then every process of ethical reflection and discernment, it's based on the facts and assumptions that you're operating with at the time. So I think given the context at the time, I mean, we might look back and say, listen, he was wrong, he had the wrong facts, but based on the facts that he had and his assumptions, I think we could say that's certainly a reasonable interpretation of what was likely to happen. Was it certain to happen? No, but was it probable? And in which case, I think that that line of thinking is completely reasonable. And I would say, yes, that's an ethical decision. Now, someone else might disagree. So we could have a conversation about which values in that case are more important, right? And some people would say, well, no, following orders should, you know, that's the most important value. I don't happen to agree with that. And I think in this case, avoiding what he saw as a potential world war seems a pretty important kind of value. So, I mean, it's this, and that's why to be ethical, we really have to reflect upon our assumptions and be constantly testing those. So when we get into those situations, we're not operating with unexamined assumptions. I mean, history is littered with people who had all kinds of assumptions about things that turned out to be completely wrong. And in some cases sort of silly because they hadn't subjected those assumptions to any kind of scrutiny. And human beings don't like to do that because it takes time and it's messy. Humans are epistemologically conservative. We don't, you know, we don't like to mess with our epistemological structure. So unless my belief gets challenged in some way, I just tend to go with the assumptions that I have. Like, I didn't question gravity when I got up this morning. Like, I just assumed it was working in the way it was working yesterday, right? And I'm not going to question it unless something weird happens and I'm like, oh, maybe I should question that. But that can be a problem for us. Because if we don't question or don't think about our assumptions, then that creates problems when we're trying to engage in ethical reflection and discernment and justification.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, what you've experienced recently, because in your prior background, you taught undergraduate students, which as anybody that has people whose prefrontal cortex is yet to fully fuse, could appreciate the challenges it have with that. But now you're over at the Naval War College with theoretically fully fleshed out adults, and a lot of which, and something we've talked about on the show here through the years, and people can argue both sides of the equation, but the Navy, and at least its undergraduate arena, really focuses on people with technical degrees, technical expertise, ones and zeros, math, engineering, ones and zeros, whereas philosophy, ethics, morality even, legality, that's the other side of the spectrum. What have you encountered, did you expect to have encountered moving over to the Naval War College in a different people sitting across the podium from you? And has there been something that you didn't expect that has surprised you either in a positive or not quite as positive way?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I went from teaching Army ROTC and civilian students at PLU to now teaching mostly military students who have 15, 20 years of highly technical experience. So I think the thing that surprised me the most is how alike actually my War College students are to my undergraduate students, in the sense that for both populations, like, philosophical reflection is not something they're comfortable with. It's not something they're used to doing. It's not, as we say in the military, it's not in their lane. So at the Naval War College, you have people who are very highly technically accomplished, but they haven't necessarily had the time or the space to reflect on their experiences in the military. or to read philosophical texts. So right now I'm teaching the Foundations of Moral Obligation, which is also known as the Stockdale course after Admiral Stockdale, who pioneered the course. You know, so last week we were reading Plato's Republic. That isn't something that most, you know, mid-career Navy officers are doing on a regular basis. So now they're having to think about things that they haven't really had to encounter or haven't had to encounter in a long time. And that's actually quite similar to undergraduates. Now, these students at the Navy War College are certainly, you know, in a different place in life. They have children. They have more family responsibilities. They perhaps have more maturity, although we had quite a few adult returning students at PLU as well. So we always had a mixed population. So I think I was just most surprised at how similar the work is, that I'm really in many ways doing the same kind of work I was doing before. You're tweaking it a little bit, and these students just have a lot more sort of life and technical experience that they can bring to bear on the kinds of questions that you're asking. Which is definitely interesting. But I think it's also hard for them. And I think that's something that I figured out pretty quickly, was that this is not a space of comfort for them. These students are used to being in charge or having command either of expertise or other people. And so being in that place of discomfort is something that requires compassion, just as it did for my undergraduate students. So putting my job as a philosopher is to make people uncomfortable, and that does not always make people happy, right? So that's been interesting. I think I was a little surprised at that, but being only slightly older than my War College students, I understand that comfort is important. I don't like being uncomfortable either. So that's been really interesting.
We've got all these things. You teach just war theory and too, I gather. Have we substituted or are trying to substitute ethical decisions with, I mean, should we do something, with decisions that are based on whether or not it's legal to do so?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think, you know, international humanitarian law and just war theory have connections and interrelations, but one doesn't reduce to the other. And just war theory is an important sort of philosophical grounding to why we have some of the laws that we have in the international realm. So I think if you only look at it from the legal perspective, then it's going to be tempting to see things as, well, this is just the law, you have to follow the law. Whereas if you spend some time thinking about just war thinking, you may come to understand some of the philosophical debates or perhaps some of the reasons why we have laws, for example, against targeting noncombatants. Or certain kinds of buildings like churches or mosques. So I think they can work together. It does make me nervous if we're going to just try to reduce all judgments to legal judgments, because then that's a matter of following rules, and rules by their nature are retrospective. I mean, you make rules or laws after something's happened. So I have a blow dryer and there's a tag on it that says, do not use this while submerged in the bathtub. The only reason there's a tag there is because clearly someone did that. And I think ethical reflection is important, because it can also think about what might happen, not just what's happened before. And so I know the Navy and all of the military branches, you know, the idea of innovation and being able to creatively think is really important. And I think ethical reflection asks you to think about what might happen or what could happen or what would happen if X happened, whereas law by its nature has to be based. It's based on stuff that has happened. so far. And of course, as we've seen with the AI debate, law can't anticipate everything. It's like me trying to put down rules for my children. At one point, I had to tell my son, you cannot hit your brother with the cat. Like, I did not anticipate that that was a rule I was going to need to make. So I think ethical reflection is really important as a separate domain, because it can complement, especially the legal realm or other rules that we have. But it can also help us think about, like, weird stuff that hasn't happened yet and things that might happen. And I think that's important, too, because I'm a big fan of the Stoics. And the Stoics are into something that they call rehearsal, which we know from the theater world, right? But we also know from military training, you don't hand someone a gun and say, good luck with that. You train them. You show them how to take it apart and clean it and how it works, and they're responsible for maintenance, and you train before you go into combat. You train everything. Well, you need to train your ethical capacities as well so that they're ready to go. If the first time you've thought about whether or not you should shoot someone is when you actually show up at the checkpoint in theater, that's a really bad time to start thinking about that. You should have thought about that before. So I think ethical reflection and developing our ethical capacities, which also include things like moral imagination and empathy, developing those things means thinking about things that haven't happened yet or that might happen in a different way than we're used to them happening. So it's kind of a creative capacity, if you will, which I think is really, really important. As you know, I think there's some things that are quite predictable about war, but there's also stuff that just weird stuff happens, just like with parenting.
You mentioned something a little earlier in the show that has kept popping into the top of my head here. So I wanted to go back to it today because I've always found it frustrating, for me at least. And that's a tendency to go towards legalism. It's like, well, right. The ROE lets us do this. This is perfectly legal. And as anybody who saw in the movie, it came out, I believe, in 2001, Conspiracy, where Colin Firth plays Dr. Willem Stuckart, and the Wannsee Conference, I believe it was.
Right.
You know, a lot of that is just, well, we passed this law, so it's legal, and we're just focused on legal, so it's fine. I mean, horrible things have been done both in uniform and out because it was, quote, legally, unquote. And I'm not connecting the two, but I've always found that the Navy's core values, the honor, courage, and commitment, was always a big lost opportunity because other people in uniform have different core values for whatever their marketing people came up with. But from a philosophical background, if we were to make Pauline Empress of the Seven Seas for the day, and one of the things you had 10 minutes to do would be to ditch the Navy core values and create something else for people to talk about or think about, or at least bubbling around in the back of their head, that you think might help or be a better substitute for what the Navy, at least on paper, calls its core values?
I think this is tough because, I mean, the core values in all of the services were developed around the same time, and I think it was an attempt to basically delineate what people thought of as virtues. The problem is the values and virtues aren't the same thing, because values can be moral. They can also be non-moral. So I guess if we were going to throw out the Navy core values or any of the core values, then I think what we have to really take, if we're going to take 10 minutes and think about, is have people think about, in your service, your way of seeing your service, how would you describe why you are here and what it is that you want to accomplish? And there may be some non-moral reasons why people are there, like a paycheck or learning skills or what have you. But I think for many people, they have moral reasons, moral commitments that they see in themselves, and they also see in the community at its best. And I think that would be a really good place to start. I think, you know, something like honor is an important word, but I'm not sure that people have a conception of what that means. So I would like to, and I often do with my students, have conversations. So when we read Aristotle, who's a virtue ethicist, we talk about the core values. And I ask students to tell me what's courage, what's honor and commitment. Those are often very difficult conversations. They can give me boilerplate language that they've heard. But for them to describe it in their own lives, it's very hard to articulate. So I'd like to get to something that's more concrete and practical, which I know philosophers don't have that reputation, but I think that's where you start. You start with what's important to you here. Why are you here? Why do you value the community, the profession that you're a part of? I imagine for many people, something like camaraderie or a sense of serving something higher than themselves would emerge as a core virtue. I imagine for a lot of people, something like honesty or integrity, perhaps a less fancy word, but those kinds of things would emerge. So probably many of the same things would emerge, but I think they'd be articulated in a different kind of way. And that might be helpful, because I find that those discussions, what does honor mean to you? Then the eyes glaze over and people are like, I don't know. And to be fair, if I were asked what that means, what does honor mean to you, and I was restricted to 30 seconds, that would be hard. Now, if I could write a 200-page book on it, I'd be fine. Let's start with the practical. Let's start with why are you here and what do you think is important about this, and then move toward the virtue rather than starting with the virtue and then trying to ask people how you apply it, because I think that's a more difficult move.
Well, I keep going back to the ethics of the individual, the ethics of the organization the individual is in, the ethics of the society that organization is in, and wondering, is there a tendency among people who worry about things like the law of war, the ethics of war, to try and punt these things up higher and higher to some, you know, say the UN as an over, if the UN says it's okay, that this is, it's right and just to do this, then that is now the blessing that everybody needs? Or is that not what is going on in the modern world? Or is this still up to the individuals and the countries and the society and the organizations?
I think in general there is a tendency to try to punt things up either up the chain of command or up to some other body. This is sort of the equivalent of go ask your mother, because, you know, people prefer in general to avoid responsibility if they can, right? Especially if they think things are going to go wrong. And in warfare, very often bad things happen. And so all other things considered, you'd prefer not to be the person that's morally responsible for that. That said, I also think we have a different conception now than perhaps 100 or 150 years ago about what are good reasons to go to war and who gets to decide whether and when we go to war. I think, you know, there was a time when it was uncontroversial that if the monarch or the political ruler wanted to go to war, he or she was the decider, to paraphrase George W. Bush. But I think now that is viewed as more complicated. The President of the United States, I think, at least for some people, would argue, should not arbitrarily just decide to go to war without at least consulting NATO, consulting the UN, consulting allies. So I think we have a different sensibility, perhaps of the stakes involved, but also of the way in which, since these decisions impact other communities, political communities and political orders, that it's no longer sort of an individualistic decision on the part of each nation. Each nation decides what's solely in its best interest, that kind of paradigm, especially since the Second World War, has become more complicated. And there at least for some parts of the world, there is this desire to have coalitions, to have alliances, not to be bearing either the cost or the moral responsibility alone. So recently we saw a lot of, as George H.W. Bush was being eulogized, one of the contributions that was highlighted was his campaign in the first Iraq war, and that it was an international coalition that he tried, presumably, to articulate things in terms of just war principles, that he tried to build a coalition, that it wasn't just the United States making this decision. And so I think for many people that is being held up as a model of, this is how we should do things. Now, of course, there are people who disagree and think, well, you know, that's not how we should do things. If the United States thinks it's in their interest to go to war, they should just go to war. And if the UN doesn't like it or NATO doesn't like it, then that's their problem, but not ours. But I think it's interesting that now it's no longer just assumed that the president or the monarch or whoever's the head of state automatically is the one who gets to decide, or who is the legitimate authority when it comes to that criterion, just war thinking, that there are other competitors for that, and that the UN is certainly one of those competitors.
That's a perfect lead into the, thank you very much for the,
you're welcome.
The question I wanted to ask you is, we've always fought with allies and in coalitions, and
right.
in many measures, the United States of America, part of the Anglosphere, Anglo-Saxon country whose morality, philosophy, and ethics goes back to the ancient Greeks, but that's our part of the world. That's
right.
Not the entire world. That, and even inside what we would consider our allies in the West or on the Western periphery, if you want to take something as benign as civil-military relations, U.S. general officers have a very different view of their civilian masters than the French general officers do, and much different than the Turks do. But we'll often find ourselves having a subordinates unit under our tactical command or control from other nations, and likewise, especially recently, U.S. working for our under the command of foreign nationals who may have a completely different framework at which their professional ethics and morality are based on. What, you know, a lot of you talk about, a lot of your students are your 18 to 20 year serving officers. So we're talking about field grade and junior flag officers, general officers to be soon. What type of tools would you recommend for them to be able to work in that environment where they should be prepared to be confronted with an ally or a subordinate unit that has a completely different structure on how they view their place relative to combatants, non-combatants, politics, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's a reality, you know. In contemporary life, there's a lot of moral disagreement about stuff, and some of it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I would say is one of the most important things that you need is a sense of intellectual humility. And I always go in assuming that my moral beliefs clearly are right and clearly are best, because if they weren't, I would have different moral beliefs. But I think we also have to cultivate the capacity to pause and suspend that for a moment. And this is where something like empathy or moral imagination comes in, and hopefully would help someone in that position try to imagine, why would someone else hold a different position? And what's the rationale? What are the working assumptions there to try to understand that point of view? Understanding a point of view is not the same as endorsing it, which I think there's a lot of, like, you know, people think, well, empathy means I'm saying their view is right. No, my kid has broken the rules and he's upset. I can empathize. I can say, yeah, that's really difficult. I understand that you're really frustrated, even if I think he completely deserved what he got. So I think there you have to cultivate this capacity to try to understand where it is that they are coming from and what the operating assumptions are, to see if you have any common ground. And it may be in uncovering those working assumptions or the reasons for why the French approach things in a certain way that you can discover at least a little bit of common ground to try to move forward with some kind of solution that, even if it doesn't make everyone happy, you know, you're moving forward on some kind of common ground. And even if you can't find some common ground, then at least you understand more where they're coming from. And it's, you don't think, oh, this person's just, they're just being recalcitrant. They're just being stubborn. They're just being stupid. Because people have reasons for their moral beliefs. And I do think that, especially for, you know, more senior members of the military, cultural competency is really critical. I mean, most Americans do not speak a foreign language, and part of the value of speaking a foreign language is not about the words, it's about learning the culture and the way when you learn a language, you learn how someone else thinks, because language roots how we think and how we express ourselves. So I think to the degree that people can try to cultivate that and take a moment and say, okay, I have moral, I'm not asking you to give up your moral beliefs. So the example I use with my students at the War College, because I have a well-known shoe addiction, is to say that what we're going to do here is ask you to try on a bunch of different shoes. You don't have to buy any of them, but we want you to try them on, walk around in them, and try on shoes that you think you're not going to like, because you don't know until you try them on. And I think that's a really useful exercise, because you don't know what you don't know until you find out you don't know it. And so I think even if you can't come to a compromise, at least you understand someone else's position better, and a basic strategic capacity. If you don't have the capacity to understand how someone else, especially how your adversary thinks, I don't think you're a very good strategist. But that's also an ethical capacity. You have to be able to understand that there are different points of view and how people got to them and what the rationale for them are in order to be an ethically aware and reflective person.
If other than taking the leadership course that you are involved in at the Naval War College, if I'm a Joe lieutenant out in the fleet or fire control technician, Smith, whatever, what can I look at to learn to think about these ethical decisions? What would you recommend as a good starting point for somebody who's interested in this?
Well, as an academic, and I'm in the process of developing an ethical development reading list, I could give you a bunch of books to read. But I actually think, especially for people at the junior level and people who are busy too, I actually think for many people, film is a much more accessible way to start thinking of some of these issues. So, for example, if you want to think about humanitarian intervention, you can go watch Tears of the Sun, which a lot of people think is a really terrible, awful movie in a lot of ways, and it is in a lot of ways. But that's a movie that that asks questions about following orders and about humanitarian interventions. You watch a movie and you have some friends, you have some colleagues, and you talk about what's the issue in the movie, what decisions did the characters in the movie made, would you have made the same kinds of decisions. So there's lots of great movies either about war or about military life, or about sort of political events. One of my favorites is The Siege, which is about a fictitious attack on New York City. It was made actually before 9/11, and as a result of a terrorist threat and attack against New York, they start rounding up members of the Arab American community. And there's a lot of interesting issues with military-civilian relationship and terrorism and all kinds of things. So I would actually start a movie club, and maybe once a month you watch a movie. And then the thing is about ethical reflection, you can do some of it on your own, but you also need a community. You need to bounce your ideas off of other people, and other people will have different moral ideas than you, and will see different things from the film. So I'd strongly advise, you know, pulling together. There's lots of great lists of, and everyone has their own favorite sort of war, military related movies. And so to start there, and then from there, if you decide there are things that you want to read or particular things that you're interested in, I think that's just, it's a little bit more of an accessible way into doing the same kind of thing and having the same kind of conversation. And then you can go read like the classic Michael Walzer's Just and Unjust Wars, which is a good basic sort of place to start. So there are things like that you can read.
Of course, not to hurt anybody's feelings, but everybody is a wonderful, special individual, and that's true. But at least in my little more than two decades on active duty, one thing that I always found humorous is, on aggregate, even in the international scene, when you boiled out your national stereotypes, they're actually pretty accurate, that every wardroom is about the same. Very similar backgrounds. There are some regular themes and patterns to why people decided to pursue the military as a profession. In aggregate, when you get a critical mass together, the stew pretty much tastes the same. And now that you're seeing a nice critical mass of senior field grade officers, have you gotten a feel, because everybody should be self-aware, but of course we're not, because our ego gets in the way and people from the outside sometimes have to put a little sheet of paper put in front of you. But as an aggregate, what do you see that are the strengths of that group, and perhaps some of the weaknesses or unattended areas when it comes to the ability of this group of leaders to be able to ethically analyze their decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the students that I see in my classes are really smart, have a great deal of technical expertise. They're up in their fields. They want to stay current. They're really committed to doing a good job. They want to be good leaders. They are willing to do, you know, self-development. They think self-improvement is important. I think most of the students I see actually think education is important, which perhaps hasn't always been the case in the military. So I think those are all really good strengths. I think people are committed to diversity and understand that there need different perspectives and that different people bring different things to the table. In terms of weaknesses, I think that technical expertise can be a weakness too, because then you tend to see everything in terms of your technical expertise. And in the military, there's a heavy bias in favor of rationality and a certain kind of rationality. But what we need is objective facts, and the objective facts will just decide the matter. But that's a particular worldview, and that's a particular way of approaching things that doesn't always track how other people make decisions. And so one of the things I stress with my students a lot, and we go back and forth a lot on, is I spend a lot of time pushing them to articulate and then examine their assumptions and where those assumptions came from. Because a lot of times I don't think we're attentive to the ways in which the views we have been habituated to have, or we have for particular reasons, and other people don't necessarily have those views. Whether it's about gender, whether it's about science, whatever it's about, those views have a source. And we shouldn't assume that other people share that source. So I think that's really, really important, because it's very easy to get in a ward room, or in my case, to get into a faculty meeting room, and you all speak the same language, you all have similar education, and then you can all speak the same lingo, and you're comfortable, which means you all share assumptions, which is really, really dangerous, because you will have blind spots that you can't catch if you're not in the habit of questioning your assumptions and asking those hard questions of one another. And so that's one thing that I hope that our courses at the Naval War College really get people, by putting them in that zone of discomfort, get them really to ask questions they would not have asked before, and think about things like maybe moral imagination and empathy that they hadn't thought about before, or that we don't typically think of as in the military wheelhouse, especially with a focus on that kind of technical knowledge. So I think there's potential there, and that's a difficult thing to do, but I think we can point to so many historical debacles that have happened because people either assume the enemy thought exactly as they did, or they didn't question their own assumptions about things. And I stress to my students that that is a really dangerous thing, that you have to do that.
So Socrates was right. The unexamined life is not worth living.
I'm afraid so. people don't like that.
Well, we're going to, I want to thank you again for coming on today, and I've enjoyed talking to you, and give you a chance to tell the listeners what you're working on, what they can look forward to seeing in the next few months, weeks, years, and it's all
Yeah, so I just finished the manuscript for a book on obedience that will be hopefully, if all goes according to plan, come out on the U.S. Naval Institute Press early in 2020, and it's on obedience in the military and in the political realm, so lots of interesting sort of current things in there, but also thinking about obedience and disobedience and all the range of things in between. And then I'm back to my blog, so my next blog piece will be actually on Socrates as a strategic leader. And so, you know, I'll be blogging a little more frequently there. And then right now I'm working on a piece on strategy and ethics. So I'm thinking about those kinds of things. So always interested in whatever the next thing is. And I've been spending some time working on AI as well. I'm writing a paper with a former student who's a PhD in philosophy, and he works in AI in the healthcare industry. So starting to try to think about those kinds of issues, trying to be out in front of things instead of waiting until they happen.
We ought to find a way to get you to talk to, we had a prior guest earlier this summer on AI, Allie Crawford, who actually was one of Robert Farley's compatriots there over at the Patterson School. And that's one of the things that we talked about with AI is we've got to think about this hard, not just what's legal and what the ROE are, but there's a lot of things right up the philosophical and the ethical realm that really need to be examined, at least for us. I don't know whether other people in the world will, but we should at least do it ourselves.
Absolutely.
And Pauline, I could go another 2 hours, but we would be selfish with your time. Really do appreciate you coming on. It's been a great topic, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk to you again in the future.
I would love that. Thank you so much, and thank you to all of your listeners. It's always a joy to talk about ethics anytime.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for this edition of MidRats. Hope everybody has a great holiday season, and we'll see you back live in the new year. Until then, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.